You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 24th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live from the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's show...
We got that down.
I think we do.
We
forgot the award-winning.
Ah.
We always forget that.
Almost perfect.
The award-winning Majority Report. On today's show, the great journalist Nicholas Koslov is going to talk with us about Ecuador, Edward Snowden, why Ecuador might want to give Edward Snowden asylum.
And why Edward Snowden would want to go to Ecuador.
Why Edward Snowden got to go to Ecuador, what Ecuador is about, what's good about it, what's not so good about it. Plenty of other things going on in the world today that we will get to. Sadly, Nelson Mandela in critical condition in a South African hospital. Get to that. More things on the amount of times that people have been brought up on espionage charges during the Obama administration. Not a great record.
The Supreme Court punts on affirmative action.
Punts on affirmative action and doesn't rule again on marriage equality. DOMA. They're kind of... They're a little shy, the Supreme Court. They're very wily. They've got the insane conservatives. Then you've got the wily conservatives. And then you have the liberals trying to keep things from totally going off of the rails there. But not really much to report on that. Like you say, they punted and they haven't ruled on DOMA or marriage equality related rulings. So
yeah, they sent the affirmative action case back to the lower court.
Right. That's the Texas, the University of Texas.
UT Austin.
UT
yeah.
Austin. Yeah. We'll see. I thought they were in the mood maybe to, frankly, peel back the whole thing. So, maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it's a good thing. We'll see.
We will.
What else do we have on the burner for today,
buddy? A not journalist calls a actual journalist a not journalist. I guess that's the best way to describe David Gregory asking Greg Greenwald why he shouldn't be charged with a crime.
And then... getting offended that Greenwald was angered by the question. That's an unbelievable piece of sound.
Just asking questions.
Yeah, just asking questions.
Like any good journalist would do, Glenn Greenwald. What are you trying to say?
Whoa, dude. What's your problem? Just after the truth here.
All right. Should we
get
to our interview?
Folks, we're gonna take a quick break. We will be right back with that interview with Nicholas Koslov. So back in a moment.
Yo, all I need is one mic, one beat, one stage, one front, my face on the front page. Only if I had one girl and one crib, one God to show me how to do things the sun did. Pure, like a cup of virgin blood, mixed with 151, one sip will make a flip. Writing names on my plotting, mad balance, who I'm gonna this hood politics, acknowledge it. Leave bodies
cooped up in garbages. Seeds watch us grow up and try to follow us. Police watch us roll up and try knocking us. One knee I duck, could it be my time is up? With my luck I got up, the cops again. Bus stop glass bursts, a fiend drops his Heineken, ricocheting between the spots that I'm hiding in. Blacking out, I stay back, getting hit. This is my hood, I'm a rap to the death of it. To everybody, come on, little this grown, look rats, don't abortion your wound. We need more warriors soon. Shit from the stars, sun and the moon. And it's like the police chasing street sweepers and coppers. Kids with no conscience, leaving victims from doctors. If you really think you're ready to die, with doubt, this is what Nas is about. The time is now.
All I need is one mic. One mic. One mic. All I need is one mic. One mic. That's all I need. All I need is one mic. All I need is one mic. Yeah. All I need is one page and one pen, one prayer. Tell God, forgive me for one sin. Matter of fact, maybe more than one. Look back at all the hatred against me. All of them. Jesus died at age 33. That's 33 from 20 to 16 apiece. That's 32, which means one of my was holding 17. 27 hit your crew, 6 went into you. Everybody gotta die sometime. Hope your funeral never get up. Tear through the innocent, nothing is fair. Roll up from wheelchairs, my heart is racing, tasting revenge in the air. I let this slide for too many years, too many times now. I'm strapped with a couple of too many to die. Really with me, get busy, load up the.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Nicholas Koslov. He is a journalist and author of Revolution, South America, and the Rise of the New Left, and several other books. Nicholas, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for doing this.
So let's just get right to it. You have a piece out, which you actually wrote on the Huffington Post, I believe, called Will Snowden Follow in the Ecuadorian Footsteps of Assange, where you kind of talked about why Snowden might be interested in going to Ecuador and why President Correa might be interested in hosting Snowden. So what's the kind of main takeaway of your article and what's going on there?
Sure. Well, I think what I was trying to get at in the piece is that, the media has paid a lot of attention to Snowden and Snowden, this personality and his history. And that's interesting, but in a sense, I think this case is now highlighting more international implications because, if Snowden winds up in Ecuador, as seems likely at this point, or at least a possibility, then I think that will highlight tensions between, or longstanding tensions between Ecuador and the United States. And this was also evident in the case of Julian Assange, who's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London now for more than a year. And so I think this is going to underscore, I think, larger tensions between Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, who seems to want to inherit the mantle from just deceased Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who's been a thorn in the side of the U.S., and the Obama administration. So I think it's really fascinating how just this this case of this one young whistleblower could ignite very larger geopolitical tensions.
Could you tell us a little bit more about President Correa, his background, his political stance, and where does he kind of fit in the spectrum of, say, Chavez, whom you mentioned, on maybe the kind of more sort of thoroughly populist left, and then maybe someone like President Lula or Dilma in Brazil, like who are maybe more center left. Where does he kind of fit? What's his background?
Well, I think in contrast to Lula and Dilma Rousseff, Correa ascribes to perhaps the more populist left in South America, and Brazil tends to push a little more conservative establishment politics. And I think Correa was something of a protege of Hugo Chavez in terms of his rhetorical style, in terms of the way that he mobilizes people for popular change. I think he it's no secret that Correa is a firebrand politician. If you compare just typical Correa speech, I think he probably cultivates a lot of the same rhetorical techniques as Hugo Chavez. And and not just in terms of his rhetoric, but in terms of his popular programs. He has cultivated some left-leaning policies. You know, he was a leftist economist. He at the University of Illinois.
He was trained in the United States.
He's been reelected, I think, twice now, and he's going to serve out his term, I think, until 2017. He was just elected in, I think, February 2013. So he's been in power for quite a long time. And during that time, he has thumbed his nose at the U.S. in a variety of different ways. First, for example, he booted the Americans out of the U.S. air base at Manta, which is this coastal city in Ecuador, and the U.S. had conducted drug surveillance overflights from Manta over Colombia, and it was a very convenient strategic location for the U.S., and then once Correa was elected, he promptly booted the Americans out of their base in Manta, which was very discombobulating for the Bush administration at the time because it had to relocate and find other bases, military bases in Colombia, which is obviously a lot more problematic because it's a lot more violent country than Ecuador.
Right, right.
And then also, you know, in the economic sphere, Correa thumbed his nose at the International Monetary Fund and prioritized social spending over repaying debt. And because Ecuador is an oil exporter, just like Venezuela, the Andean nation has benefited from windfall oil profits and has been able to invest a lot of that money in the social programs, much as we saw in the case of Venezuela. And also, unlike some of his predecessors, Correa has been a lot more reluctant to conclude a free trade deal with the United States. And he's brought Ecuador into the Venezuelan orbit. He signed on to the ALBA agreement, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, which had been pushed by Chavez, which is a very innovative social economic agreement, which is predicated on barter trade outside of the normal corporate strictures and this free trade that's pushed by Washington. So in a lot of ways, Rafael Correa has challenged the United States diplomatically, economically, and militarily. And now, through his harboring of Julian Assange and possibly Edward Snowden, I think this situation could become even more inflammatory because the United States could retaliate against Ecuador, which is still a pretty impoverished country. And I think Ecuador has a lot to lose. And I on a certain level, I wonder if Rafael Correa has a sense of the long-term repercussions of what he's doing because, you know, the U.S. could retaliate in terms of trade because Ecuador has something called the Andean Trade Preference Act with Washington, and Ecuador exports tropical fruits and flowers as well as oil to the United States. And under preferential terms. But because Ecuador is politically controversial, you know, Correa has very few supporters on Capitol Hill and let alone the Obama administration. And so I think even before this Snowden affair, it looked like this Andean Trade Preference Act was going to expire, which has, you know, huge repercussions for impoverished Ecuador. And so, if anything, I think the Snowden imbroglio could lessen the chance of the Obama administration or Congress renewing the Andean Trade Preference Act. So again, I think these cases tend to highlight the international tensions.
What is the reaction to with people from Ecuadorians? Do they support Correa wanting to support these people like Julian Assange and Edward Snowden? Does he have support on that level? Or, I mean, he's putting a lot on the line for someone who isn't an Ecuadorian citizen.
Well, I don't know how much support Edward Snowden has in Ecuador. This is pretty much a breaking story.
Oh, no, I mean Korea, but, like, for example, with Assange. Did Korea have a lot of support with that?
Well, I think that in terms of his support of Julian Assange, he got some nationalist support in Ecuador. Don't underestimate the importance of or the political strategy of thumbing your nose against the United States. Ecuador is a small country, but it doesn't like to be pushed around by the United States. A lot of people are aware of U.S. meddling in Ecuador, which goes back to 1960. The CIA has been meddling in Ecuadorian affairs for 50 years. So I think Correa is definitely aware of that. He definitely takes advantage of that in terms of his rhetoric. But I think it's a double-edged sword because he can shore up his nationalist base by thumbing his nose at the U.S., but also there are real economic repercussions, and it could give rise to poverty. You have these industries like the flour industry, the oil industry in Ecuador, which are pretty important. So I think Correa is going to have to weigh his options very carefully.
So, Nicholas, I wanted to actually get to something you had alluded to there. There's obviously the potential economic consequences of this sort of approach, but then there is this other history, maybe the inverse of the economic history, but obviously it's connected, as you said, of kind of CIA interference in Ecuador and really across Latin America, obviously. Now, it seems like there's been a shift, at least to a certain extent, in U.S. policy, where there isn't the same type of, you know, there aren't kind of U.S.-sponsored coups happening, sort of all the time across Latin America. But that said, is that another – I mean, even again from the perspective of, not necessarily even a coup, but the U.S. Coordinating or the economic consequences being felt to such an extent that Ecuador switches back to the right and elects a new government either through a connected maybe more explicitly with U.S. policy or just, as a reaction to some of the potential economic consequences you're talking about.
I'm not sure I entirely understood you. The connection is not 100%.
Oh,
but
the phone connection.
If I understand you correctly, I think Ecuador's always had a volatile politics. Governments come and go. Actually, Correa has been in power for pretty much a record number of years now, given just how short-lived a lot of governments in Ecuador have been in recent years. And so I think for Edward Snowden, if he gets diplomatic asylum, then you have to wonder, well, if Correa gets thrown out of office or another government comes to power, are they going to be so amenable to these kinds of high-profile cases? And so I think that's definitely a concern. I think Ecuador is just a very impoverished country, politically unstable. There's just been a host of, before Correa came to power, there was just a host of governments that just came and went because Ecuador had to pay off its debts. It was Washington was imposing or ramming through the neoliberal agenda and economic austerity, which is very unpopular in Ecuador because it results in cuts in social spending. And so you also have these combative social forces, the indigenous people, who any time that any government in Quito wants to impose austerity, then they'll block roads and mobilize the people. And so it's very unstable. And I think, if anything, Correa has been probably the most, probably have the record amount of time in office, given the short-lived regimes prior to his election in 2006 or so.
What how is Correa's what is the response to Correa from the other South American countries? How do they feel about him? Does he have support from the surrounding areas?
I think yes. I think Ecuador definitely forms part of this leftist network that includes Bolivia and Venezuela, certainly Cuba and Brazil, to a certain extent, Argentina. You will find variations, not all of them ascribe to his populist approach to politics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also populism is a kind of a mixed bag in South America, because some other countries in the region, like Brazil, are a little more cautious, and so they might tend to be a little more alarmed by these fiery politicians like Chavez or Correa that really stir up the masses. And I think some of the other countries tend to be a little more cautious. But I think, yeah, generally speaking, perhaps they tend to support Ecuador. But I also think that they would not necessarily host Edward Snowden or Julian Assange.
Mm-hmm.
And because precisely for these reasons that I'm saying, they tend to be a bit more cautious. I wrote an article, I think, about a year or so ago about some reports suggesting that Brazil might harbor Julian Assange. And there was actually some talk about that. President Lula praised WikiLeaks and thumbed his nose at the U.S. briefly. But I think, unlike Ecuador, some of these countries would be a lot more, I think, reticent to offend the United States. And I think, and I've also written a lot about this in terms of the WikiLeaks cables.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the public rhetoric is one thing, and you always hear these South American countries railing against the U.S. And expressing anti-imperialist sentiment. But if you look at the WikiLeaks cables behind closed doors, a lot of these countries, they talk to the Americans in a lot more cautious terms, and also tend to negotiate or to betray the confidence of other leftist nations. And so what the United States is able to exploit these divisions in South America, because publicly they're against the U.S., but behind closed doors they say disrespectful things about each other. They're trying to negotiate with the U.S. also behind closed doors. And so I think there's a lot more division amongst the left in South America than is commonly reported.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to, I guess, you know, support these things from afar and not face any of the consequences of harboring someone like Julian Assange or Edward Snowden. But when it comes to Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, one of the things that the press here in America constantly talks about when these people apply for asylum in Ecuador is Ecuador's history of freedom of press. You discussed that in your article. Can you go a little bit more into that?
Sure. Well, I think on a certain level, the fact that Edward Snowden might wind up in Ecuador is a little ironic, just as Julian Assange's situation with Ecuador is also ironic. I mean, both of these people are whistleblowers. They're trying to expose government secrets and give rise to more freedom of the press. But it's a little ironic that Snowden would wind up asking for diplomatic asylum from Ecuador, because whatever his public policies, whatever his rhetoric and his policies against the U.S., Correa leaves something to be desired. And so I certainly applaud Correa for challenging the U.S. in, you know, the diplomatic, economic sphere or what have you. But that doesn't change the fact that I think in many respects Correa should give the international left pause. Ecuador just passed this communications law, for example, which is a very slippery slope, potentially leading to censorship. Under the law, Correa can appoint his own representative to supervise the media. And so anyone who is potentially lynching a public figure or publishing something that's a defamation of a public figure, then the government can impose stiff penalties against journalists. Mm-hmm. So that has a very chilling effect, and it's also very subjective. How do you define defamation? That's really subject to all kinds of abuse. So the committee to protect journalists and other organizations and Ecuadorian newspapers are very concerned about this. Now, I don't mean to defend the right-wing media in Ecuador or Venezuela or a lot of these countries. A lot of times they're scurrilous, too, and shameless. But that doesn't change the fact that Correa is trying to pull a fast one. He's doing his own power play. And I think the communications law raises a lot of concerns. So in that sense, Snowden's plea to get diplomatic asylum in Ecuador is a little bit ironic. And then there are some other ironies that I get to in the article.
I want to follow up, actually, on some of those with you.
Nicholas,
can you hear me?
Raised some other political concerns about Correa.
Nicholas, I want to follow up on some of those other concerns that you raised in the article. And I think it connects, too, with the position that Snowden's been put in and the kind of broader questions around a story like this. The other things that you mentioned in the article specifically with Correa are the fact that he also domestically has some very questionable human rights tendencies with the indigenous population of Ecuador. And then you also noted that he's pushed for better relationships with countries like Belarus or Iran, which also have, you know, really, really poor human rights records. And then when you look at where Snowden has been, I mean, there is obviously a lot of irony in, leaking and whistleblowing the United States and then going to Hong Kong, Russia, and now Ecuador. Ecuador probably has the best record of those three, but certainly, has its own question marks around it. Russia has a terrible record in regards to these things, and China, of course, also is a difficult situation. So do you think that there is a way – what's the outlook, though, practically speaking, for someone like Edward Snowden, who's done what he's done, to not get kind of drawn into these broader questions of geopolitics and just kind of, crude national interest, essentially – that sort of take away from maybe some of the issues that he's trying to highlight through his whistleblowing?
Well, I think that's a very good question, but I don't know realistically what the solution might be.
Right.
I think you would hope that he would pick a more idealistic destination, but I think what this situation highlights for me is that no country is problem-free.
Right.
And I think realistically, Ecuador is probably better than Hong Kong,
right,
or Russia.
Definitely.
But I think Korea leaves something to be desired in addition to this controversial communications law. He's also been no friend to social movements in Ecuador who are fighting for their own rights over natural resources. And, for example, he sent in the police to repress indigenous peoples who are concerned about mining and oil exploration on their lands, and they wanted to preserve their water resources. And then, Correa sent in the police and called them infantile, and two people got killed and many wounded in the Ecuador and Amazon.
Right.
And I picked up on this actually as early as like 2007. I was in Quito doing some research for my book, and I went to the Indigenous Federation in Quito, and I just expected them to be very, very pro-Correa. But this was very soon, just after his first election, and they were very, very skeptical. And I think that's not surprising given just how many times indigenous people have been betrayed by ostensibly leftist politicians in Ecuador, and they just turn around and basically betray them. And I think if anything, since I went to Quito, there's been even more friction between Korea and some popular forces. And then there's this further irony, as you noted, that Ecuador thumbs its nose at the U.S. I agree with a lot of the policies challenging the U.S., but I'm also critical of some of these South American countries that just go so far they want to challenge the U.S., that they go so far in the direction of embracing really backwards and reactionary countries.
Right.
And there's this very disturbing case of Ecuador establishing, links with Belarus, which is, talk about ideological throwback. You still have the KGB in
yep.
Belarus. It's a very repressive place. And there was I think Korea was potentially exposed as hypocritical just last year because, just at the time that he was going to extend diplomatic protections to Assange, there was another high-profile case in Ecuador of a dissident from Belarus who was a former army captain from Belarus who exposed high-level corruption. And then actually he was doing some research on the Internet, and then he discovered that, Ecuador actually has very lenient laws, and maybe I should pursue diplomatic asylum in Ecuador. So he went to Ecuador, and, to his credit, initially, this is back in 2010, Correa gave him diplomatic asylum. But then, going back to this questionable foreign policy, Correa, in an effort to counteract the U.S., established an alliance with Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus. And in 2012, Lukashenko touched down in Quito, and Correa and Lukashenko signed all of these bilateral deals, most disturbingly on military technology. And then shortly after Lukashenko left, the Ecuadorian police raided this dissident's house, Alexander Barankov, the dissident who had previously gotten refuge in Ecuador, and threw him in jail where he was promptly assaulted.
Right.
And he probably would have languished there had Time magazine not published a really withering article condemning Correa as a hypocrite for giving diplomatic asylum to Assange, who was anti-U.S., but then clamping down on some dissident in the effort of cozying up to Belarus, which...
And a dissident who, incidentally, is not a global media star.
After all of this, Correa relented, and so the Belarus dissident was released from jail. But it reveals, I think, a crass sort of foreign policy, which is a little bit cynical. So that it looks like Correa's just thumbing his nose. He's trying to get high profile cases. But he's not politically consistent. He's not politically consistent on all cases of diplomatic asylum.
And I think that, another very clear example of that, and I'm less clear on some of Correa's positioning, but in terms of the kind of his political kinship with Chavez and perhaps Ortega in Nicaragua, the reactions of Chavez and Ortega to the Arab Spring and the uprising against, really brutal Middle East autocracies – was also, incredibly cynical and just really, really politically crude. I have one final question for you, which is a little bit of an addendum, but I think it was highlighted when you were talking about the Ecuadorian indigenous population. And I'm wondering what, there's obviously, we've talked about things that are left that are problematic with the kind of new Latin American left, and then some great things that have been associated with them as well. But what is the environmental record maybe we could leave it specifically to Correa. You already kind of alluded to some of it. But in general, do these governments have a better approach to the environment or global warming or the Amazon or no?
I think it's been a pretty mixed bag, and I think that's you've exposed the potential Achilles heel of a lot of these leftist governments. And I think I think that a lot of these social forces, be it indigenous peoples or others, they propelled Correa, Lula, and Chavez to power initially because there was this reaction against the U.S. economic policies and military and diplomatic influence or otherwise. And so I think for a while there was, I think, an alliance between the social movements and a lot of these leftist leaders. However, I think over time, I think the gap between the promise of these leaders and the aspirations of the people is widening, as we see right now in Brazil with right. the recent protests. But also, as you mentioned, on environmental questions, and I think Ecuador has, I think, some problems with the environment precisely, and is it trapped in this extractive economy. Mm. In other words, extracting its commodities to export to other countries, be it oil or other natural resources. And so I think Correa has not been able to extricate himself from this extractive trap, and that's really exposed, I think, a big gulf between the president and his former supporters, because he has had some innovative environmental proposals on the Amazon, but nevertheless, he hasn't been able to get out of this extractive trap, and as a result, there have been a number of confrontations in the Amazon over natural resources. And I think over time, the South American left is going to have to pay a lot more attention to the environment if it wants to avert a lot of these conflicts that we've seen in recent years.
Wow, fascinating. Nicholas Koslov, thank you so much for your time. And I would, you know, recommend everybody, if you're interested in any of these issues related to Latin America, social movements, the environment, you should definitely read Nicholas's work, for sure. Thanks again.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for doing it. Thanks.
Take care.
That was very good.
It was really, really interesting.
We had him on. We last had him on when Chavez died.
Yeah.
And I wish we had him on before that, because I learned a ton about Chavez. I mean, this guy knows the Latin countries for sure. I mean,
he goes, and I just love the way he's able to just play out so many different things, so many different variables that are going on. Because, you know, in some ways, these governments, what they did over the last several years, some of the things they've done have been really exciting and really positive, and especially in Latin America. I mean, just even the fact that, you know, a guy like Morales is president of Brazil and being of indigenous background, and, you know, subverting that legacy of only, you know, people, the racial, the economic divisions. And then on the other hand, you know, these governments have also really sucked in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And been huge disappointments and are really autocratic and problematic. And he just does it really well. He just sees a lot. He's a really, really smart guy. So it's cool to have him on.
Do you want to continue with our...
I guess we'll continue with our
NSA leaking, Edward Snowden coverage.
One thing we will say, Matt texted me over the weekend, or he texted me last night, and he was like, one thing I will say about Edward Snowden is that this guy is like, he does everything on Sunday.
Yeah, the guy just loves awesome. Breaking news on Sunday.
He's like,
it's like, makes our life easy. We just come in and we're like, all right, let's pull those Edward Snowden stories.
So really quickly, I'll get to this in a second, but like, is he still in Russia? Is that the notion? Because he was supposed to be on this Havana flight.
Yeah, right, maybe we should update.
Just give a brief update about what's going on.
So basically yesterday, the report came that Edward Snowden was leaving Hong Kong with an envoy, I guess you can say, of WikiLeaks' law team.
I've read about it. I didn't realize
I mean, I assume WikiLeaks supported him, but
sure.
WikiLeaks being involved in this directly just like sort of happened yesterday. I mean, obviously it was leading up to this. They were working with him. But
right.
I mean, that broke yesterday. And they apparently were getting him into Russia, to Moscow. And there's a lot of problems right now between whether or not he was able to legally leave Hong Kong, because it just so happens that on Saturday – the United States revoked Edward Snowden's passport.
Yeah, but the Hong Kong government, essentially said, well, we're going to let him leave because the extradition request that the United States has filed with us doesn't fit our laws,
our bilateral agreements
with the U.S., so we're letting him go, which is interesting because that confirmed some of the initial theories of why you go to Hong Kong, which is their extradition laws. So they did play to his advantage in terms of allowing him to travel.
But you know, it's also interesting, the fact that passport information about his passport being revoked, it was asked, I forgot who was asked, probably the State Department, was this true? And they said, as a matter of privacy to Edward Snowden, we can't disclose that information, which means somebody leaked it. Now, is the United States going to go after the guy who or girl who leaked that passport information?
Well,
or is that type of leak okay?
Well, I think the thing that really I'll get to this. I'll come to this story. I'll get to that through this story.
Well, let's just quickly
So
apparently he's in Moscow, and he booked the next flight out to Havana, Cuba.
Right.
And that which was supposed to be today. And there was a weird people weren't sure if he was already in Moscow yesterday or if he was headed to Moscow because RT said he was in Moscow, yet people saw RT and a ton of reporters waiting at a airplane gate ready to take pictures.
Yeah, they were literally waiting at the terminal.
No photos ever came out. So there's a question if he even ever arrived in Moscow at all or if that was just like a false flag operation. No, but
I prefer
but
ruse.
So all these reporters purchased tickets on that flight to Havana. They boarded the flight, and as the plane's taking off, they all realized, hey, that one empty seat there, Edward Snowden never got on. So there's all these reporters headed to
and they need to be, and I think Havana they can't, right now. They won't be cleared to leave. They have to stay in Havana for at least 3 days, I read. Logistically, they can't. But you know what?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. It's not like you're going to, like, I'm not even going to think of the place. Havana is not a bad place to be for a couple of days.
Edward Snowden's, where in the world is Edward Snowden? I was trying to remember that show, Carmen Sandiego, yeah. But, all right, so Edward, no one really knows where he is right now. Julian Assange, take this as you will, said that he is currently healthy and safe in an undisclosed location. More interesting is that the White House just said that Hong Kong made a deliberate choice to release Snowden and has damaged U.S.-China relations.
Well, I mean, I think obviously U.S.-China relations have been damaged already.
Snowden, letting Snowden go is what damaged the relations, not everything else.
Obviously it did. I mean, look, to be fair here, I mean, the Chinese have, like, you know, epic meltdowns every time the Dalai Lama is seen by anybody in the United States. And that is the exiled head of a country that they illegally occupy and brutally violate the human rights of for a good 50 years. So, you know, let's not – again, I think it's important with these things to not – no one has clean hands here. By any stretch of the imagination. But anyways, let's – so what has come out? So Edward Snowden – and I'll just say right off the bat, I think Edward Snowden, you know, I don't have a problem with him being charged with something, okay, like theft of a document, whatever. But he's getting charged with espionage, which even by – and this is according, first of all, to the 1917 Espionage Act, which probably many listeners of the show will be aware is a just – horrible piece of legislation. The whole impetus of that legislation basically was to criminalize dissent during World War I. It's a really awful piece of legislation. And even within that awful piece of legislation, it's not clear to me, and again, being really agnostic about, and I'll get into, there's some things that Edward Snowden's done I'm not a huge fan of. I'm not, you know, I don't see how anything he's done, even according to the most draconian definition of espionage, well, maybe according to the most draconian definition of espionage, because that's what's being yes. used. But I don't get how it is. He didn't sell documents to a foreign country. He didn't.
Which he could have.
He could have. He could have smuggled them. He could have. He could have profited immensely. And this brings us to a bigger problem, which is that in charging Snowden with espionage, the Obama administration has added to its count of people that it's charged with espionage, and it's more than – it's the eighth person to be given this charge, and that is more than any other administration has ever attempted to use this charge since the law was passed in 1917. I'm just going to read this here. Yeah, this is from Slate. Prior to the Obama administration, only three people who leaked information have been charged with the 1917 statute that was never really intended for leakers. Although, I don't know. The arguments that Obama uses now to use that statute to go after those who reveal information were first brought up by Ronald Reagan's administration when went after a Navy civilian analyst who leaked photographs to a British military magazine. But now the practice has become more widespread. Obviously, this is a big problem, and there's two reasons it's a big problem if you look specifically at the Obama administration. One is, I think, just like Matt mentioned, the whole backdrop of these questions of leaks and whistleblowing is that if the Obama administration, it would still be a problem from the standpoint of investigative journalism and government accountability if they were as kind of far-reaching as they've been in their use of these statutes and in going after whistleblowers to begin with. But what compounds the problem is that the administration, just like Matt said, and we don't know who leaked this thing about Snowden's passport, but when you get to stories about successful U.S. Foreign policies that are classified, like Stuxnet, like specifics of the bin Laden raid, the Obama – certainly people senior within the Obama administration have been quite happy and quite content to leak to their preferred journalists and get their story out there. So that is a whole other aspect of this problem, is just how selective the entire process is and what a sort of stunning double standard there is. And this includes – and by the way, even to make the artificial distinction that, you know, well, what someone like Snowden does – has jeopardized U.S. security and the leaks that the Obama that people in the Obama administration hasn't, because that's not necessarily the case. When it emerged, that the CIA had used a fake vaccine, polio vaccine program in Pakistan as part of their path to getting bin Laden, it's the very least hurt public health efforts in Pakistan. And actually, a couple weeks ago, a couple of AIDS workers were tragically killed. Doing that work in Pakistan. So that's one really big problem, is the selectivity around the leaks. And I think the other thing, and this is just, you know, this is speculative, but I think it's reflected across the board in the Obama administration's approach to this, is this real, it seems to me, a confusion, a dangerous confusion of campaigning with national security and governance. Because, you know, the Obama campaigns have always ran very effective campaigns. They prided themselves on low drama. They had zero tolerance for leaks or infighting. And that served them well politically. And now that same mentality is being brought into government. And it's a really big problem. And it's reflected in the uses of the Espionage Act. And it's reflected in the double standard around leaks, because that literally, I mean, you know, that is a literally, that's an, again, we keep seeing all these parallels. If you work at HSBC and you launder money for, you know, global drug cartels and terrorists, you're not going to get charged. If you, you know, and now it's like, you know, the informational equivalent in terms of leaks and who gets called to account for leaks. And maybe everybody should get called to account for leaks, or far fewer people should to begin with. So anyways, that's that on the espionage front. espionage charges.
I think we have completely wrapped up everything that's gone on since Friday with Edward Snowden. I mean,
yeah, you're informed, folks.
Snowden loves doing things on the weekend.
He's a weekend operator.
You know, it's also interesting they chose to drop those espionage charges on a Friday evening.
Didn't they do that right around the time of his birthday? Isn't his birthday? He's turning 30.
I think he's turned 30, yes.
Yeah. I mean, the use of espionage charges in this case and these other cases is very disturbing. Now, as I've said, I think that, you know, there's different batches of leaks here. And I think the NSA stuff is very legitimate. We need to have a conversation about it, and we need to figure it out. I think the hacking stuff, I have different feelings about. And then the last batch of, like, you know, that we're spying on Russia, as an example, I don't really – I'm starting to get confused, to be honest, about what I don't get the mentality. Like, if he thinks that spying in and of itself is an amoral activity, I mean, I don't – I should say I don't. I think that that's a practice that a lot of countries engage in. Every country engages in. It's not an intrinsically amoral thing. I mean, when we did last week, when we covered the new leaks on the monitoring of the G20 summit, we brought it quickly over to that report from 2004 about how the Bush administration had wiretapped the UN, because, you know, that to me is a much more clear example of violation of the sanctity of the UN, and then that was in the context of trying to hype and lead up to the invasion of Iraq. I don't really understand what's so shocking or problematic about keeping an eye on the Russian economic delegation. So, you know, that's just my view. It's a worldview that I don't totally buy, that every single thing needs to be disclosed. But that doesn't mean that the motivation is espionage, obviously. And it clearly isn't by his actions. So.
All right, folks.
We got to plug the stuff.
Let's plug it now. We gave you a lot of free stuff on Thursday and Friday.
Lots.
And I think we might have gone over a little bit today when we were assuring ourselves we would not give you even more free stuff than you've already received.
So the basic point being,
become a member. You can become a member by going to majority.fm and clicking that link up top that says, it might not be quite clear to you, so let me spell it out. It's become a member. That's what it says. That's what you will become when you go through that process of paying us via PayPal.
You'll feel so satisfied.
If you have a problem with PayPal, which is totally cool, you can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will work out a payment method that is okay with us both.
And can I just say, we get emails all the time, or not all the time, not as many as we should, but we get a lot of emails from people saying, I feel so good that I finally become a member.
Yeah.
It just feels great. It feels good to put your money where your mouth is. Buy stuff on Amazon.
Buy
books. Buy, I mean, I don't really buy anything.
Yeah, you can buy anything on Amazon. Everything
through us. Makes no difference to you. Gives us a little piece. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on YouTube.
Gives us a little piece.
Like us. Yeah, let us wet our beaks
a little bit. Gives us a shekel, as Sam would say.
Yeah, let us wet our beaks a little bit. sign up for our YouTube channel.
At youtube.com/SamSeder. You can also support this show by following us on Twitter, Majority FM. You can like us on MySpace, Facebook.com, MySpace. Did I just say MySpace?
You did.
On Facebook. Wow, where am I? What year did I fall into?
You cannot.
Facebook.com/MajorityReport.
I'll tell you what, if you can find us on MySpace.
I don't think we're on there.
We will play a shofar for you.
You can follow Michael and I on Twitter as well. You can follow Michael at _MichaelBrooks.
I was very late to the Twitter game.
And you can follow me at Matt Binder. No underscore there, just Matt Binder. Michael has the underscore before his first name.
Yes,
all right, enough about that.
Enough.
Members,
see you in the better
members,
half, folks.
You're in for a great better half. Let's do this.
All right, cool.